Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Africa Link. My name is Assumpta Latus and here are our main stories. In London, a four-day conference opens to combat sexual violence in war zones.
There are lots of women that seem to be extraordinarily brave in order to actually present their very, very personal stories to the world and to say the shame is not on us, but it's actually on the perpetrators.
Gunmen kill a top influential moderate Muslim cleric in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa.
We have lost an important person in our religion.
Stay tuned for those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
In South Sudan, face-to-face talks between President Salva Kiir and his rival and former deputy Riek Machar were expected to take place in Addis Ababa on Tuesday. The two have been leading rival forces in a civil war that has now been raging for 6 months. But as the day went on, the start of the talks was postponed and it looked increasingly unlikely that they would take place. However, the two did begin individual talks with the president of Ethiopia at the presidential palace, indicating that there was perhaps a chance for some kind of deal to come at a later stage. However, observers are not too optimistic as a previous cessation of hostilities agreement was broken by both sides. As the waiting continues, the suffering of the many displaced persons in South Sudan also goes on. Many now live in overcrowded camps. For women especially, it is a time of great hardship. Their stories form part of the testimony provided by victims of sexual violence at a four-day conference that has just begun in London. To find out more, I have been talking to DW reporter Birgit Maas.
I have seen a huge range of participants. There are survivors of sexual violence in Congo and Burundi, actually a lot from Congo, which has been a major conflict, but also a journalist, for example, from Colombia who was investigating drug cartels in Colombia and who was abducted and raped and tortured, actually, and is still speaking up for women and for victims of sexual violence. There are lots of women that seem to be extraordinarily brave in order to actually present their very, very personal stories to the world and to say the shame is not on us, but it's actually on the perpetrators.
You talked about many countries participating in that conference. Let's take a closer look at the situation in South Sudan, where there has been a civil war going on since last December. How bad is the situation there?
I've spoken to somebody from a charity, Save the Children, who's just returned from the country. She says it's particularly dire because a lot of people, 1.3 million people, are displaced. The majority are women and children, and always when they are on their own, so to speak, in refugee camps, they are particularly vulnerable. Now, South Sudan has always been a difficult country to be a woman in. She says you are more likely to die in childbirth and to finish education. So women's issues were never really on top of the agenda in that country. But at the moment, it's a particular problem. And also it's something that's massively underreported because it's a huge stigma in that society to actually come forward and speak out on what has happened to you. It's disappointing, she says, because in the peaceful years, there have been actually a lot of grassroots organizations that have been trying to help women to support rape survivors. And there was a lot of activity, and the feeling was that there is a positive movement in that country. But now that it's gone back to violence, it's very, very difficult for women indeed.
Is this conference really going to help the victims of sexual violence? Are there plans for concrete measures to be taken?
First and foremost, the aim is to give victims a voice, to encourage them to speak up, also to put pressure on governments and make clear that the international community does not look away, but to keep the pressure up. I've spoken to a number of NGOs who do hope that there's some concrete step. There's a protocol that's hopefully going to be launched, and that is supposed to coordinate what people are already doing on the ground, some sort of guidelines to coordinate teams of forensic experts, of doctors, of prosecutors who gather evidence on the ground that it can actually hold up in court, because difficulties are that often when these crimes are committed, it's dark, the women do not recognize their perpetrators. Often they are dragged deep into the bush and they have to walk for days. They might be injured, they might be weak, they have to walk for a long time in order to get help and to deal with all these very concrete difficulties on the ground. There are some guidelines, hopefully, and the NGOs, that they will not only be just launched, but that they will actually put in place and implement it.
Birgit Maas speaking from London. You're listening to Deutsche Welle's Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latus.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
A top influential moderate Muslim cleric, Sheikh Mohammed Idris, has been shot dead by unknown gunmen in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. He was the chairman of the Council of Imams and Preachers of Kenya, CIPK. This is the fourth cleric killed by unknown gunmen in Mombasa since the beginning of the year. From Mombasa, Eric Ponda brings us this report.
Mourners weeping at the morgue after the arrival of the body of Sheikh Mohammed Idris. The 64-year-old moderate cleric had been on his way to morning prayers, just a few meters from his house, when he was accosted by unknown people on a motorbike at around 5 a.m. local time. He was shot in the abdomen and later pronounced dead on arrival at Pandya Private Hospital. Sheikh Idris was also the chairman of Sakina Mosque in Mombasa that was recently taken over by radical youth. He was a Muslim cleric who opposed radical teachings within the mosque, says Mahmoud Mohammed Jahazi, a regular worshipper at Sakina Mosque.
We have lost an important person in our religion.
Idris's death will be seen by many as a revenge attack by those opposed to his moderate way of Islamic teaching at the Sakina Mosque. He repeatedly urged the government to arrest the key financiers and radical preachers whom he accused of using innocent youths for their own interest. Idris's message was that Islam is a peaceful religion that does not advocate violence to achieve its aims. Idris's death is the latest killings of Muslim leaders in the city, although previous shootings have been of radical leaders rather than moderates. Speaking shortly after Tuesday's attack, Mombasa County Commissioner Nelson Marwa said that it was premature to blame anybody and called for calm and patience as the government carried out their investigations.
Investigation is on based on the suspicious characters who were seen there. And that's why we are saying you give us some time.
President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to bring the killers to book. Sheikh Idris was buried on Tuesday afternoon at Kikowani Islamic Cemetery in a ceremony attended by, among others, a former prime minister. He leaves behind four wives and 25 children.
Eric Ponda in Mombasa. Still to come, a story of the first female police officer to fight human trafficking in Ghana.
Africa on the move.
African lawyers have warned banks and people leaking and managing illicit money from the African continent to watch out. They say they are committed to fight for the repatriation of money illicitly taken out of the continent. The lawyers had been meeting at their General Assembly in Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. Illicit money costs Africa about $50 to $60 billion a year. Moki Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Faison Winifred, who works with Investment Fund, a local Cameroonian bank, makes entries into a desktop computer as customers queue in with deposits. Her bank is one of several others which African lawyers accuse of funding capital flight from the continent. Faison strongly rejects these allegations and says they are there to do business, nothing more.
Whatever the source of your money, we don't know, but we welcome those who want to deposit money. Why then do you discourage the person by asking, where is your source of income from? So we encourage everybody who come to deposit money.
Do you have any highest amount or an amount which is the highest somebody can deposit in your bank?
No. So we don't even care. There's no limit. Whatever amount you want to deposit, we like it.
Failure by African countries to enact legislation to check cash flows is fueling illicit outflows, according to Nigerian human rights lawyer Femi Falana. He criticizes Nigeria's law on curbing illicit cash outflows as being outdated.
In 2011, the National Assembly amended the Money Laundering Act to allow anybody traveling out of the country to go out with any amount once you declare it. That is primitive. What used to happen before then was that nobody could go out of the country with more than $10,000 cash. Any other amount beyond that has to go through a banking process. But when you say I can just make millions of dollars, get to the airport, declare it, and take it out, for me, it's primitive.
Femi Falana adds that the chain of corrupt banking systems in Africa and others in the developed world is facilitating in this organized crime.
There was a time they said Cameroon and Nigeria were the most corrupt countries around the world. And I said they are foolish people. I told them, if people steal money here and they are kept in the vaults of Western banks, as far as I'm concerned, the farther you provide safe haven for looted wealth from the continent of Africa, you are guiltier.
The president of the Pan-African Lawyers Union, Zambian-born Elijah Banda, says transferring illicit cash is a complex process.
The way we understand financial flows is not people cutting boxes of cash across the borders, but it is being undertaken in a very serious way in multinational transactions, transfer pricing between corporations and their sister corporations overseas. Copper-based countries that have an extractive industry are very prone to these activities. In Zambia, we know that money is leaving the country, which should not, in form of proper declaration of taxes, in form of proper declaration of profits by these multinationals. All those now become illicit flows.
After the cash has gone, it becomes very difficult to trace it, says Anna Gardner of the London-based non-governmental organization International Lawyers for Africa.
Firstly, there has to be due diligence in the victim country to identify how much money is missing. Then there is a process of, once that's identified, to get court orders to say that those assets have now been identified, they need to be frozen, and then the process, the real process, then starts. It's a long and convoluted process. The burden of proof is too great. Well, you need lawyers, but you also need real estate agents, you also need forensic accountants, you need bankers. I mean, there's a whole range of different disciplines that are required to work together.
Despite the difficulty in tracing and returning stolen money, the African lawyers say they are committed to keep fighting for the return of cash which belongs to Africa.
Our correspondent Moki Kindeka reporting from Yaounde. And if you were wondering what he is doing when he's not investigating or doing investigative reports for us, now this is the answer. He is following the fortunes of the African teams participating at the FIFA World Cup. Today, he is visiting Abidjan, and the team in Brazil is the Elephants, with Kolo Touré and his brother Yaya Touré and Didier Drogba featuring in the team. They are the top favorite from Africa.
Loudspeakers placed at strategic places such as in populous neighborhoods of Yamoussoukro and the capital Abidjan blast songs of encouragement. Also, discussions on the streets center on how further the Elephants of Ivory Coast can go.
I have confidence in my team because we have some of the best players in the world, like Yaya Touré and Didier Drogba, who are some of the best players in European club size. I have faith that my team will represent us.
We have the best players in Africa. We have good players and a good defense. At least we shall be able to go beyond the quarterfinals in the World Cup. There is no reason why we should not be able to.
Ivory Coast is among the top teams in African football, but some people in Ivory Coast doubt that the team, which includes Ibrahim Bakayoko, Didier Drogba, Aruna Kone, Kolo Touré, Yaya Touré, Emmanuel Eboué, Bakary Kone, Aruna Dindane, Bonaventure Kalou, Laurent Poku, Youssouf Faliku Fofana, Abdoulaye Traoré, can perform well in Brazil.
Le jeu qu'ils pratiquent quand ils sont dans leur club The way they play on their teams in Europe is not the same way they play at the level of the national team. When Drogba, Maestro, and the other players come to the national team, they're not combative on the field.
In football, players should have a spirit of understanding. You can have the best team in the world, but if there is no understanding, the players cannot succeed. I'm sending them a message that they should not be rancorous and quarrelsome. I hope they have heard me.
While listening to the music of the legendary artist Magic System singing for the elephants of Ivory Coast, I drove from the center of Abidjan to the neighborhood of Yukungon. This is where the father of Ivory Coast strikers, Kolo Touré and Yaya Touré, lives. His name is More Touré. The retired soldier had bought a new TV set so that he, together with his neighbors, can watch his children while playing in Brazil.
When my children play well, many people come here expressing happiness, saying, "Ah, Mr. Touré has given us good children," and I happily buy for them drinks. But when the elephants are losing, people come here with cans to beat us, asking why my children did not perform well. I ask them if I am a player.
At the neighborhood of Kokodi, Albert Drogba told me he will also be watching with neighbors. He says tension always grips his family when their son Didier is playing.
His mother goes to the toilet at least 10 times when Didier is playing. I cannot visit the toilet because his mother spends all her time going there and coming back.
But still many Ivorians are not sure if their state television will be able to broadcast the matches without hitches. I raised the issue with Amadou Bakayoko, Director General of the Ivorian State TV, RTI.
We are going to have a team in Brazil, but we are mobilizing to deploy reporters all over Ivory Coast to share the emotions of our people following the matches. Mobilization is total to give it a successful coverage.
Many people I spoke to in Abidjan are counting on the African teams to do their best and prove to the world that African teams can also be champions.
That was Moki Kindeka with that report. Looking forward to watching Ivory Coast's first match in Brazil, which will be on Saturday. I'll be there.
Making a difference.
In Making a Difference this week, we meet a Ghanaian female police chief who is helping to combat human trafficking. Superintendent Patience Kwaye was the first head of Ghana's anti-human trafficking unit within the Ghana Police Service. After almost a decade of her work, Isaac Kalezi met Kwaye to hear her story.
So you just came back from town? You just came back? And you'll be going out again?
Yes.
When I first met Patience Kwaye, she had just returned from Kensington, London, in the United Kingdom, where she was awarded at the Women for Africa Awards Night for her role in preventing human trafficking in Ghana. But being a police woman was not what Kwaye had in mind when she was growing up.
I wanted to be a nurse, but later I took the exams and I took one also for police. And at the end of the day, I passed the two. So it was my daddy who said it's better for me to take the police job because of the way I am.
Her dad was proven right when Kwaye was named the first female police officer to head Ghana's anti-human trafficking unit. Before taking that role, she used to work with the international police known simply as Interpol. And as she told me, it's an experience she encountered while on duty that led her to want to do more to stop human trafficking.
I was posted to open that unit. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was working at the Interpol. Okay. And I was the desk officer on the trafficking table. And so when we started rescuing people and I saw how vulnerable, especially the children, The first boy that I rescued was a boy who was sold by the stepfather to a Nigerian Alaji. And after that, I said, no, we need to do more. At the end of the day, that is what God wants us to do.
The anti-human trafficking unit has been in operation for almost a decade now and has succeeded in rescuing thousands of children and adults from trafficking. Most of those she has personally engaged in rescuing have been teenagers who were sold by their parents. These are some of the children Kwe helped to rescue. With support from the International Organization for Migration, IOM, most of the children have been given an opportunity to start new lives after being reunited with their families. Ajo Edem is 16 years and was sold to a group of fishermen at Yeji in Ghana's Bonohafa region. She worked on plantations and along the Volta Lake for months. Edem described as horrible the conditions she worked under. She's happy to have been rescued.
I work from morning 6 to evening 6. I don't eat on time. Even if I'm sick, they don't take any good care of me. I heard that they were coming to rescue our life. I was most grateful when I heard this. And now I'm free from being trafficked. Now I'm most grateful. I'm happy because I have started a new life.
Kwe says stories like this move her and inspire her to continue to lead the unit to rescue many persons who are still falling victim to the trafficking. She disagrees with the general notion that poverty is the major reason why people fall victim to the menace.
We recently had one case where a woman gave her child out for just one Ghana cedi. So is it poverty? That one Ghana cedi cannot do anything. So some, I think it's ignorance, lack of education and all those things. So there are a whole lot of things. It's not only poverty because it is our attitude and what it's building us.
Patience Kwe says stopping human trafficking requires the participation of everyone. She called for more awareness to inform people about the dangers of human trafficking.
With trafficking, like I said, the people that they've been sending out, they are almost all educated. So whether you are educated or not educated, the people can just lure you out of the country. Anybody, whether you are old, whether you are young, if you are not careful, you will or you fall victim.
Whether in the field combating human traffickers or in her bureau giving orders to her juniors, Patience Kwe is hoping to bring to an end one of the worst forms of human rights abuses in Ghana.
Isaac Kalezi reporting there.
Listen to Africa Link where and when you want. Subscribe to our podcast and you will get the latest edition sent to you. Log on to mediacenter.dw.de/English/podcasts and look out for the Africa Link podcast. Africa Link, bringing you the story where and when you want it.
And before we go, here is a quick look at our headlines. Gunmen in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa have shot dead an influential moderate Muslim cleric who was a vocal opponent of the radical preaching of Al-Shabaab insurgents. And a four-day international summit to end sexual violence in war zones has been opened in London. That's it from this edition. For more stories, visit our website at www.dw.de/Africa. And for comments and questions, drop us a line at our email address, which is feedback.africa@dw.de. Or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Or send us a text message to +49 160 9575 9510. Till tomorrow, I'm Assumpta Latus. Thanks for listening.